You're listening to Navigating Diversity, where we explore how human beings differ, yet can find ways to relate to one another in an increasingly xenophobic socio-political climate.
This is Julie Raymond. Last week, host Christoph Kassoon and guest Nylee Alvarez discussed the topics our local, social justice heroes, and police brutality and implicit bias. You can catch their conversation on kisu.org/program/navigating diversity. This week, I'm stepping in to host a very special episode. We are shifting our conversation away from racism and the Black Lives Matter movement towards the criminalization of immigration in the United States, particularly as it relates to international student populations. To help us navigate this topic, we are joined in the studio by Christoph Kassoon, doctoral student in political science at Idaho State University, and Dr. Colin Johnson, assistant professor of political science at ISU. Dr. Johnson, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, implemented a policy this past week that shook up the lives of international students all across the United States. Can you tell us a little bit about the policy?
Right before I get started, I need to say that I'm just here as an expert, so I'm not speaking on behalf of ISU, the College of Arts and Letters, or the Department of Political Science. So you're just getting my thoughts. But when it comes to this question of ICE and the policy that was announced, this is a reversal. So standing U.S. policy when it comes to international students, if they are going to complete a degree exclusively online, they're not awarded a visa. That is, it's just seen that if you're doing online, you don't need to be physically in the U.S., you don't need a visa. Obviously, COVID disrupted education K through 12 into tertiary education as well. And so this rule was suspended for the spring semester, suspended for the summer, and statements in March, it appeared that it would be extended into the next academic year potentially. But in July, we had a reversal. And the ICE policy essentially states that if a university goes to exclusively online education, then the international student visas are invalid and they must return home. And that goes for at any point in the semester if a university goes exclusively online. And so suddenly, international students attending institutions, it is up to another body to decide whether or not they are able to have legal status in the U.S. and to be able to continue their educations in the U.S. So it's been a sudden shift that took everyone by surprise.
Christoph, as an international student, how did this policy affect you and the international student community?
Devastating. I mean, one way to put it, it was absolutely heartbreaking. So many of us woke up and we saw the news and it was just eerie seeing a policy that so explicitly described you. It literally said like non-immigrant F1 visa status. And it was like, that's me. But just more generally speaking, I think international students were already having such a hard time given COVID-19. So many of us had to cancel all our plans for traveling. We have no idea when we're going to get to go home and see our parents again and hug our mothers and our grandmothers. So many of us lost our jobs. International students can only work on campus. So if your campus closes and there are no jobs on campus for you, you can't work anywhere else. And it's not like if we have family and parents here to support us, right? It's pretty much us by ourselves living in places where we don't have anybody we know all that much. So this policy pretty much said to international students, you're not valued. It pretty much was risk getting COVID-19 or get deported. That was kind of the two options that it came down to for many of us. And in my opinion, I don't think anybody should ever have to choose between getting deported and dying from a pandemic. That's pretty inhumane to me. I've seen a lot of people saying things like, oh, well, international students don't necessarily need to be in the United States territory if they're taking classes online. And yes, I understand to a point, but international students don't come here just to get a degree. It's so much bigger than that. We're not just people in a college paying fees for a certificate. Like, we're actual human beings with emotions and we live fully realized lives and we have friends and relationships and hopes and dreams. And we come here with our hearts open to the country, wanting to gain whatever knowledge we can here and maybe contribute and maybe even become part of this country one day too. So to say, oh, well, you don't need to be here because your program is online is just kind of saying, well, you don't see us as fully realized.
That makes a lot of sense, Christoph. Dr. Johnson, how does this policy affect ISU and other universities?
Well, I can't speak, you know, in an official capacity for ISU, and so I don't have a lot of details in terms of institutionally the exact numbers in affecting ISU, but the answer is tremendously for ISU and for other universities. As Christoph's saying, our international student body contributes on campus. It is not just a fee-paying population that is in a classroom. They are full-fledged students participating in dialogues, and especially at ISU, with such a diverse campus, the international student body, and even as a professor in the classroom, bring a different perspective, bring the capacity to really enrich the lives of not only students, but faculty, and indeed the entire community, not only at ISU, but in Pocatello. When we think about this national picture, I don't know if listeners really understand the scope of this. This affects approximately 1 million students. It's just over 5% of all of tertiary education in the U.S. Suddenly, you're taking out 5% of that student body. The state of Michigan calculated that their international students contribute $1.2 billion to their economy every year. So in COVID, this is a really devastating policy decision, because a lot of universities do rely on the fees that international students pay. And so when you're talking about cutting out a bottom line of approximately 5% of those students that would be paying into tuition and other fees at a time where both for public and for private universities, they're feeling budget squeezes, this just makes it worse. It's leaving it to universities to say, well, we can either take this economic hit, this financial hit, and send our international students home, or we have to make choices we would otherwise not want to make and do in-person classes simply to collect fees, which is not how we feel about our international students, but we're stuck. And so this forces the hand of a lot of universities to go to either a hybrid, or they would be exclusively online. It's really forcing their hand to open. And that's where we have seen pushback, simply because it's a policy reversal that was not communicated, not hinted at. And it's left a lot of universities flat-footed in terms of, what do you mean? We're already facing a budget deficit, and now you're doing this to us as well. What is the logic here?
Christoph, what has the response been like from Idaho State University on this issue?
First off, we're really lucky to be at ISU as international students right now, because ISU did not make the decision to go fully online before the policy came down, like Harvard and MIT and some of those other schools. Those international students at those schools, this has already happened to them. I still have a chance here. I know that my administration and my faculty will do whatever they have to do to protect us and take care of us and fight this as far as they can. As Dr. Johnson said, ISU is moving to a hybrid model. How it's going to work is whatever classes are in person, we're going to rotate the students that are there in person. So on the Monday session, half the class would come. The Wednesday session, the other half comes. The Friday session, the other half comes. And that's kind of how they're going to do it. So at least by doing that, we can somewhat appease the immigration requirements, while at the same time giving international students the flexibility to decide for themselves how much they want to be in person or not. Because at the end of the day, that's a choice each individual person living in a pandemic has to make for themselves. Nobody can tell you how much you have to show up for anything. So at ISU, I think we should be okay as long as something terrible doesn't happen this fall. I mean, if we have another severe outbreak and ISU has no choice but to move online, at that point, I'm not sure what will happen. I really don't know if there's anything that could be done at that point. But as of now, since we still have this little window, we should be okay. International programs at ISU is working very diligently to make a plan for international students. They've sent out a lot of emails of support. They're currently figuring out how they are going to give all of us adequate advising by the time school starts, because each and every one of our individual course loads has to now be approved through immigration. So I think it's going to be really interesting how this plays out, but I feel supported and I feel protected.
That's good to hear, Christoph. Dr. Johnson, I've got a big question for you, and this is really something we need an expert to answer. Can you explain to us how we got here? how we got to this place, and what's the trajectory of immigration policy been like in the United States within the past 50 to 100 years, maybe?
Okay, so immigration policy, you know, it's a huge arena of policy in the U.S. And just like other large arenas, whether healthcare, even just education, tax code, a lot of different interests are represented in that policy. And so the way we try to split it up, at least conceptually for immigration policy, we tend to chop it up into regulatory policies and integrative policies. And so if we think about federal government sitting down and saying, international students, what do we do about them? Well, the regulatory side is really thinking about, okay, what about numbers? What's the process? How do we decide which international students should be awarded this F1 visa? Is this about criminal records? Is it about managing security? Should there be a ceiling for the U.S. labor market? How should we think about these things? Very different questions than, now that we have international students, what do we do for them? How can we help them integrate in the sense of what is their access to healthcare? How do we support their education? Are there ways in which we can support them being able to stay and work in the U.S.? And so these two different approaches to the same question, we get different emphasis on regulatory capacities versus integrative. So we get disjuncture sort of policies where in this case, we have a million international students, a very welcome population in terms of being able to contribute to universities and usually paying higher fees. A lot of institutions have relied on international students to support withdrawing public support or, you know, needing to stay competitive for private schools. Different calculations, international students have been very helpful to maintain the bottom line for universities. But when it comes to how we got to this kind of a moment, I would say that's more about the increasing criminalization and securitization of immigration policy, and it does explicitly affect international students. So a big shift, for example, was actually back in the Clinton administration when in 1996, a law was passed that basically changed the threshold for when violating immigration law became a criminal offense, and especially a felony. And once you are convicted of a felony, you are not allowed a visa to enter the U.S. again. And so by changing that threshold, what ended up happening was, you know, as someone that has studied abroad but also been abroad, I have definitely accidentally overstayed or didn't quite register when I needed to. It was a civil misdemeanor. I paid a fine. I filed the paperwork. I was allowed to stay. Sometimes things just happen. But in this case, what it ends up doing is it criminalizes those sorts of violations. And this can make sense to the listener in a common sense sort of way, I think, where you can think, well, if you break an immigration law or rule, you shouldn't be allowed to return. We need people that follow the rules. And that does make intuitive sense. But the issue when it comes to immigration policy is because it sits at the intersection of so many different interests, the reason for these shifts in policy are not exactly where we would want them to come from. So this shift in the Clinton administration towards a greater criminalization of breaking immigration law, it isn't from a surge of cases of overstaying visas. It's not from a overall trend. It was really the Clinton administration saying we need a win. We need a bipartisan win, and we need to look tough on crime. How are we going to do that? And at that point in time, Rahm Emanuel, as chief of staff, said, we can really ratchet up the crimes and seriousness for immigration violations. It was just seen as we can exact this policy change onto immigrants, and it's a political PR win for us. That's not a great inspiration for this kind of shift in policy that suddenly make immigrants afraid of any violation. International student, much less labor, international, you know, worker here. Going into the 21st century, the securitization piece comes in from a post 9/11 world. Because there might be a question that listeners have of why is ICE getting to dictate this? How is it that the agency that's there to enforce, arrest, or deport immigrants is the one actually affecting international students' access to education? How is that not Department of Education or Department of State? And the answer is 9/11 shifted the securitization policy in the U.S. And when it comes to international student education, It's because one of the 9/11 hijackers was on an international student visa. And so in the years since 9/11, essentially it was just seen that, yes, the U.S. State Department will be responsible for administering visas and deciding who will be awarded a visa. But when it comes to regulating or overseeing that student body, we are going to leave that to ICE, an enforcement agency. And so this is where we can see that regulatory versus integrative sort of capacity shift. Suddenly, international students were part of an increasing fear or concern about the foreign, the other. And so that really shifted the understanding of what are these students? What are they bringing? If you have ICE enforcing it, it's a slightly different perspective. And this is where we get these points of disjuncture where this regulative and integrative missions for different policies, they conflict. Because suddenly, ICE has changed its policy here at the beginning of July. Now, the State Department is having to answer to ambassadors, to foreign dignitaries, to all sorts of questions as to why are you doing this? U.S. State Department is not in control of that decision. They might still be part of the executive branch, but they don't share an address with ICE. And so they're caught suddenly having to defend a shift in policy where they were giving visas, assuming they would still be valid under how ICE had stated things in March. And as Christoph was saying, students were at this point when COVID happened. Do I return home? For certain students, there might have been a fear that there would be a change and they wouldn't be allowed back in the U.S. But now a lot of international students decided to stay during the summer, and now they can't go home. There are a lot of students that are having to question, do I talk to my government to get a pass to be allowed to return, even though I am in the U.S., because of regulations against Americans traveling, because of high exposure rates and infection rates here in the U.S. to COVID. And so how we got to this point is basically institutions we wouldn't normally think would be in charge of an international student population actually are, and they can work independently. And in this regulatory understanding, we can see how that framework or that approach to the immigration question could lead to this decision, but it really did come out of nowhere in terms of what had been stated before. It was an absolute reversal that took every institution and every international student blindsided, absolutely.
If you're just joining us, this is Julie Raymond, and you're listening to Navigating Diversity. Dr. Colin Johnson, Christoph Kassoun, and I have been discussing the topic, the criminalization of immigration in the United States. Dr. Johnson, how does immigration policy in other Western developed countries differ from the United States?
You know, there are significant differences, but there are some similarities. So if we think about the Western developed states in the world, most of them operate on a visa system. So we are similar in this way. Obviously, the EU has been integrating in a different way regionally. But when we think outside of the EU, a lot of these similar sort of policy mechanisms for deciding who is allowed to come or on a bilateral basis, which countries are friendlier, we do see some similarities. Where we really diverge is, again, if we think back to immigration policy as being an integrative camp and a regulatory camp, maybe we're somewhat similar to a lot of our quote-unquote peers when it comes to that regulatory side. But that integrative side, we diverge. The U.S. really does not offer a lot of publicly financed support for immigrants. And so when it comes to access to healthcare, access to additional services, the U.S. just does not have near the welfare state or the public goods provided in comparison to Canada, the EU, and some of these other peer states. So when it comes to this sort of policy decision from ICE, it affects international students in the U.S. in a way to where there's not a high degree of integrative capacity in the U.S. And so when the regulatory aspect changes, that is the most important for immigrant lives, and that affects them the most because there isn't a lot of support for them otherwise. They really are, for the most part, on their own. Whereas, at least for myself, I know when I was an undergrad, I studied abroad in Estonia and was an international student outside the EU, but was automatically integrated into the EU's overarching student body, essentially, Erasmus, which they facilitated social life, connected students, gave them the same student health insurance plan. So I was paying different fees as a non-EU national, but I had access to that entire social structure, that support system. It's a very different experience. And so that's something that when it comes to the U.S. changing policy suddenly, it completely changes international students' understanding of, am I even welcome here? And as Christoph was saying, can I try to plan for a life here? I don't get that sense right now. And that is devastating, not only for students trying to start their tertiary degrees, whether bachelor or PhD, much less trying to finish or just continue on. And so that's where we just see that this sort of policy takes the floor out from underneath international students in the U.S.
Christoph, what are some of the struggles that international students face in navigating the immigration bureaucracy?
I think a lot of Americans don't understand how difficult it is to even get to this country. And we're the good ones, right? We're F1 students. That's technically a good immigrant. H1B, good immigrant. J1, good immigrant. So many international students are not only first-generation college students, they're also first-generation college students going to America. And I did grow up in a family where I had parents and uncles and aunties who knew anything about the American system, much less the American college system, much less how a Trinidadian was going to find his way there. So a lot of it I had to figure out on my own. All the paperwork I had to apply for, applying to the embassy in Trinidad, getting approved, applying for CVIS. You learn so much language and so much different things about American immigration at such a young age that doesn't make any sense to you. And it's really scary, like probably going to the embassy to do your visa interview is probably one of the scariest things we've ever gone through because you have no idea how it's going to go. You have no idea what is going to happen in that interview. If you're going to say the wrong thing, if they're going to find something in your background, you have no idea what you're walking into. And just the joy you feel when you do get your visa approved and you know, like, oh my God, I have a chance to come here and, you know, make something of myself and contribute to the world in a way I probably couldn't have if I was stuck at home with limited resources. And it's almost like if the door is held open for us, but the second we come in, all doors close. And that's kind of what this policy sends to us. Why did you let us come here if this is what our life was going to be like? It's just kind of confusing and contradictory. International students deal with a lot of bureaucracy, and financially, again, we pay so much more than domestic students into our universities. And I think a lot of the times people don't understand that we're not here for free and nobody's really paying our way here. We're paying for these things when there is an international night on our campus that is paid for by us. It is paid for by my parents and the money they send for me every month. International students have it difficult. Mental health is so hard for international students. It's devastating leaving your country and coming to such a foreign place at such a young age, not knowing a single person and having to figure everything out on your own. And you live in two worlds. You're always living in two worlds because you have your family back home and your culture back home, and then you have a whole world here, and you never quite feel like you're fully in one. You always have one foot in and one foot out. You never feel like a whole person. You're always kind of torn between two places. I just want people listening to have a little more empathy and take some initiative and do some more research and talk to international students, reach out to them and have a conversation and check in on us. Check in on your international student friends. And right now, if you live in Pocatello, Idaho, and you do not know an international student who you consider a friend, something is very wrong. It's time to support us and get to know us and realize, like, we're so much more than just a statistic on a spreadsheet.
Christoph and Dr. Johnson, what are some things that anyone listening right now can do to alleviate the situation?
Talking to international students, making friends with them, showing up for them, letting them know you're there. I think that sends a message because a lot of us are not okay right now. Be a good ally and not a performative ally. Those are two very different things. And this huge burst of social activism and social consciousness we've been seeing in the past few months, not only in America, but all over the world, a lot of people are just kind of checking the boxes. They're showing up at the protests and holding up the signs and taking the pictures for Instagram, and they're putting the burden on people of color and, in this case, international students to educate them. I think people need to just be good citizens of this country, the actual citizens of this country, the people who were born here, because even those who've been naturalized are at stake as well. Even if you have a green card, you are at stake. And international students are in a very vulnerable position right now where even speaking out against the issue could get us in trouble. Anything could really happen at this point. So this is really a time when the people who are technically safe in this country, who are secure and have the full rights of being an American, this is when they step in and put all that privilege to use, put themselves on the line for the people like us who can't really do much right now. Our hands are tied. Reach out to your congresspeople, talk to your elected officials, call up your local government offices and find out what they're doing. Sign petitions and donate money to help international students, pay some rent or buy books, or if they get deported and their border is closed, even if they could get their country to agree to let them in, how are they getting home? How are they paying for a flight? How are they arranging transportation? There's just so many different things that people can do to support right now.
That was my list as well, because Christoph does put the onus on American citizens like myself for a reason. So much about immigration, when we think about an everyday and an interpersonal sense, is really like the ethics of the guest and the host, where when we think about what would we as a community invite, like here in Pocatello, but even nationally, inviting these populations in to contribute to our university and to have this exchange. I mean, this is also affecting just students wanting to study abroad for a semester. Something not even as significant as wanting to do an entire degree and possibly try to work here. This affects our capacity to demonstrate that the U.S. is indeed open to the rest of the world. It threatens what we've been saying to the international system for decades, if not centuries. And so immigrants are in a very particular situation because they cannot actually advocate for themselves. And when we think about the extreme position of precariousness, where they are now international students, approximately 1 million of them are waiting for a few court cases to decide for those attending institutions that have already committed to going online, whether they need to try to transfer. There's been a lot of conversations about how to support those students. So I think Christoph is right to where we need to be talking to our elected representatives about this, because immigrants can't do that. They don't have that kind of access to our elected officials. We have to do that for them as the host, for our guests. But even more so, I think Christoph is right to where if you don't know an international student, one of the best things to do is just try to meet one. And I don't, you know, and I assume there are plenty, but it's also making sure that you might be reading the news, but there's a lot going on in the world right now. And by ensuring that your networks extend to vulnerable communities, international students will know about shifts likely before the American population generally does. And this, you know, in terms of news stories, I can understand if a lot of listeners are sort of blindsided by it. It might be all news to them because that kind of social network might not extend to where they're aware of these things. So the onus is on us. We invited these students here and they are contributing and we are having this collaboration that is potentially excellent. But now we're suddenly in a position where it's all threatened and our guests do not feel welcome. And as someone that's from the South, absolutely not. Guests must be felt comfortable and everything done to ensure that they feel safe, they feel secure, and feel welcome.
This is Julie Raymond, and we've been listening to Navigating Diversity. Dr. Colin Johnson, Christoph Kassoun, and I have been discussing the topic, the criminalization of immigration in the United States. Join us next week at 7:30 p.m. on Tuesday as we continue to navigate diversity and explore how human beings differ, yet can find ways to relate to one another in an increasingly xenophobic socio-political climate. For more information and all episodes, visit kisu.org/programs/navigating diversity.
I'd like to thank Julie Raymond for stepping into the host role this week for Navigating Diversity and for allowing me to assume the guest role to tell my story.